You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast and radio show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview that my co-host Gary Lee Miller conducted with the author L.S. Hilton. You'll also hear my own conversation with Claire Benedict about summer reads in 2016. First up, L.S. Hilton. She grew up in England and has lived in Key West, New York City, Paris, and Milan. After graduating from Oxford, she studied art history in Paris and Florence. She has worked as a journalist, art critic, and broadcaster, and is presently based in London. Here's a little information about her new novel, Maestra. By day, Judith Rashleigh is a put-upon assistant at a London auction house. By night, she's a hostess at one of the capital's notorious champagne bars. To get what she wants, she's transformed her accent and taught herself about wine and the correct use of a dessert fork, not to mention the art of discretion. She's learned to be a good girl. But when Judith is fired for uncovering a dark secret at the heart of the art world, and her honest efforts at a better life are destroyed, she turns to a long-neglected friend, a friend who kept her chin up and back straight through every slight. Rage. She will cross every line. Feeling reckless, she accompanies one of the champagne bar's biggest clients to the French Riviera, only to find herself alone again after a fatal accident. Tired of driving and the slow crawl to the top, Judith has a realization. If you need to turn yourself into someone else, loneliness is a good place to start. And she's been lonely a long time. Maestra is the beginning of a trilogy that introduces the darkly irresistible Judith Rashleigh, a femme fatale for the ages, whose vulnerability and ruthlessness will keep you guessing until the last page. When Gary Lee Miller interviewed L.S. Hilton, he asked her to start by discussing her main character, Judith Rashleigh.
Judith Rashleigh, the protagonist of Maestra, is an assistant in an auction house in London, and to make ends meet, she also has a night job in a rather dubious bar. When she uncovers a fraud at the place where she works, instead of getting praise, she gets fired, and in desperation, she accepts an offer from one of the clients of the bar to go to the south of France for the weekend, where, after a rather unfortunate accident, she suddenly finds herself on the run across Europe. The plot involves art theft, art fraud, the Italian mafia, oligarchs, boats, it's got guns, it's got murders, and hopefully it's got a lot of really good jokes as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. One thing that really interested me about Judith is she's a person who wants to fit in and doesn't. At the start of the book, it's the art world that she's really trying to make her way in, and why can't she fit in this kind of high-end art house where she's working?
Well, I think the elephant in the corner here is class. I think Judith is 25 when the book begins, and she's a product of a generation who's been, I think, sold a tremendous cultural lie, which is that if you only work hard enough, run fast enough, you know, believe enough in yourself and build your brand on Instagram, then you too will succeed. And of course, this is absolute nonsense, particularly in the art world, where jobs are not only very difficult to come by, but extremely badly paid, if indeed they're paid at all. And Judith is very well qualified. She's extremely hardworking. She's ambitious. She tries to do everything right. And then she realizes that she simply has no value to her employers because she's just not the right kind of person. And so she decides that she's tried to do everything the right way. What's going to happen if she does things the wrong way? And so she takes the prejudice, both class prejudice and gender prejudice, and turns it back on the people who've used it and uses it as her weapon against them. And yes, the Judith doing things the wrong way produces some fairly extreme and intriguing results.
Right. She mentions more than once in the book her, you know, using her rage, capital R, and I feel like that's really core to what's driving her.
Absolutely, yes. Judith is quite unfeminine in many ways. I mean, she's not particularly emotional. She's not interested in romance. She has a lot of anger inside her, and she uses that as a source of strength. She uses it to get out of her difficult background and to get to college, to get the job she gets. And then in each of the situations that she finds herself, she finds that anger is something that can, it can propel her, it can help her physically, it can help her sort of ignore risk, it helps her sort of ingenuity and her intelligence. But I wouldn't say that this is in any way a revenge fantasy. I mean, it's quite a playful book. I know that sounds odd, given some of its themes. I mean, it's not everybody's idea of playful, but for me, it's quite lighthearted in the end. It's an exercise in pleasure as well as in violence.
I was going to ask you that, you know, and I think you've succeeded in that because I felt,
Thank you. Even though
Judith does things that are quite, quite brutal and
yes,
you know, horrifying, yet I still like her.
I'm so glad you say that, because I was interested in trying that. Could I make up someone who is essentially really quite unsympathetic? I mean, she's quite a horrible person. And a lot of readers have reacted very negatively to her. I mean, it seems to be a book, it doesn't seem to be a neutral response. People either really, really love it or really, really hate it. And I think that's a lot to do with the character. But she's not a character who asks you to identify with her, but she's a character who asks you to go along with her. And I think part of that is because although she has very many bad qualities, she does have quite a lot of good ones. She's quite loyal. She's capable of great friendship. She's got a very strong sense of fair play. And she's also quite funny. She doesn't take herself too seriously, and she laughs at herself quite a lot. And sometimes I think maybe that, some readers have not quite liked her for her lightheartedness about some things. But I think it's a bit in the way that Quentin Tarantino's films, if you stopped and analysed what's going on, you think, oh my God, this is horrific, this is appalling.
Right.
But the way that the choreography works, it kind of takes you along in the story, and maybe at the time that you're kind of laughing, even when perhaps you should be wincing.
Right. You mentioned earlier when Judith loses her, she loses her job in the art world, but by then she's already been working another job that she finds through Leanne.
Through an old school friend, yes, in this rather dubious champagne bar.
Yes, rather dubious. But I also feel like in that dubious champagne bar, maybe it's not that she's discovering it, because she's probably known she has it all along, but we're discovering a power that she has, and she's now going to use, and that's her power over men.
Well, that's right, and it's something she says quite explicitly, in that in her supposedly grown up job, her real career, she's, you know, treated badly, she's made out to be a dog's body, nobody's remotely interested in her brain. Whereas in sort of slightly inversely, in the very sort of old fashioned and sexist environment of the champagne bar, she suddenly feels valued and important and is actually, you know, getting on well. And this was quite a sort of deliberate inversion of the way the world's supposed to be, because in the real world, Judith, you know, her brilliant qualifications and her hard work count for absolutely nothing. Whereas in the world of the champagne bar, it's all about what she's capable of making men do. But of course, that's dependent on her intelligence as well. I mean, it's not just that she's attractive. And in fact, there's no physical description of Judith in the book. We don't know what she looks like. All we know about is how she thinks.
That's interesting. Was that deliberate on your part? Not.
That was absolutely deliberate, yes. I didn't want to prescribe to readers, this is sexy, this is how you have to be attractive or have power. And I also wanted readers to be able to imagine their own version of Judith. What's been very interesting and also very flattering is that the book's now been sold in 38 countries. So I've done lots of interviews in different parts of Europe, and people have told me, well, this is what Judith looks like, and they're completely convinced by their own version, and they start looking in the book saying, yes, but it says here, and I said, well, no, it doesn't. So people have conjured a very distinct image of Judith, which I think is fantastic. I think it also adds to her mystique and perhaps slightly to her menace. We don't know what she looks like. She could be sitting next to you at lunch and you wouldn't know. I like that about her.
Yeah, although when you do the movie, you're going to have to figure that out, I guess. Huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously the casting won't be anything to do with me, but I think it would be fun to cast a really unknown actress, someone who audiences could potentially see just the character and not a star in the role.
Right. One thing I loved about this book was it revealed to me two different worlds that I did not know anything about. The first was this world of art, a world in which, you know, there's huge money involved, there's huge reputations and egos involved, and the risk of fraud and double dealing is everywhere.
Yes, very much so.
How were you able to portray that in such a convincing way?
Well, I studied art history. I interned briefly many years ago, very briefly, at an auction house. I've written about art history and written as a critic. I got a friend of mine who is the chairman of Sotheby's to read the book over and make sure that I hadn't made any egregious mistakes, or that my knowledge of how the actual process of selling pictures works, I thought that maybe might have been a bit outdated, so I had him read that. And I also did quite a lot of research into the sort of criminal aspects of the art market. And it's very interesting to note that I think its Art Price Index estimates that as many as 30% of artworks in great museums might be fakes. Equally, in Italy, after guns and drugs, the third biggest earner for the Italian mafia is art fraud. Art is a well-known means of money laundering. There's a lot of academic papers on the subject of that, which is something which is also picked up on in the book. So the connection between art and crime is quite close. And I think the art world is also a place where, you know, there's a lot of money, it's glamorous, it's full of egos, and it's full of desire. So obviously corruption is going to enter into that very quickly.
Yes, I guess in a situation where you find someone with a lot of money who wants something so badly.
You've got wealth, you've got beauty, you've got, you know, something that people are almost prepared to kill for, then corruption can enter that very easily. And that's what I wanted to portray. But it was also important to me to show the mechanics of Judith's work in the auction house, because we have to believe in her as someone who knows about art. We have to believe that she can tell the real thing from a fake. We have to believe that she's got a good eye. And that's why early on in the book there are quite precise descriptions of the kind of work that an assistant would actually do on a daily basis.
I found it really fascinating. I really appreciate
it.
Thank you. I was utterly convinced and intrigued by the whole thing. Early on in the book, the world shifts to another world, and that's the world of kind of the hyper rich on the Mediterranean, on board the yachts.
I made a mistake. It's always a stupid mistake, but I did look at a couple of aneurysm reviews when the book came out, and there was one review very pleased with himself, who was saying the thing is that, you know, the writer of this book clearly knows nothing about people with money, because she would know that they're, you know, people with real money are not vulgar and they're not showy and they're not flashy, and he said my millionaire friends are very discreet. I thought, that's nice, you've got some rich friends. The whole point is that she's not in a world of old money. Once she gets into the boat world, she's in this very new, very flashy, very vulgar kind of rootless Eurotrash tribe who float along the Mediterranean every summer. It's very anonymous, people come and go, and it's all about money. And the contrast between that and the world she's come from at the auction house, one of the ways in which that's flagged up is not only their sort of vulgarity and brashness, but the fact that they buy art, but they buy it in the way that they buy any other kind of commodity. They see it simply as an investment. They have no understanding of it or appreciation or aesthetic pleasure, and that's something that Judith has to learn to negotiate in a completely different way.
Right. And how did you, I felt like that world also was very convincing, and did you have to do the same level of kind of inquiry? Or
I was very fortunate to be able to spend some time on one of these boats, and also living in Europe, going on holiday in Europe. I mean, you see them; they're there. You can go and have a look at them if you want to. So it was partly observation and partly experience. But this might be a good moment for me to read from the short extract of the book that you asked me, because it's precisely on this subject.
That would be fantastic.
Okay. So here we go. This is a passage where Judith finds herself on this billionaire's boat and is beginning to get used to her surroundings. Wealth creeps under your epidermis like poison. It invades your posture, your gestures, the way you carry yourself. From the moment I stepped aboard the Mandarin, I don't think I opened a door. I certainly didn't carry a heavy bag or lift a dirty plate. If the price is cozying up to some ancient boar who eyes you in the jacuzzi like a rutting hippo, the payoff is being surrounded by young, uniformed men with broad shoulders and clean nails who hold out your chair, fetch your napkin or your sunglasses, adjust the cushions on your sun lounger, pick up your dirty knickers, and thank you for permitting them to do it. They don't look you in the eyes. You are not for them. They clear away the ashtrays and the smeared mirrors, discreetly replenish the aspirin by the bed and the Xanax and Viagra in the bathroom cabinet, repair the insults to your flesh in hundreds of subtle, complicitous ways so that you stalk among them immaculate as a goddess, and in a while, between the brim of your Ray-Bans and the tip of your imperiously tilted chin, they disappear from your sight. But don't let the accoutrement distract you. If you don't get the ring on your finger sharpish, you're screwed. The real difference between the Riviera hotties and the crowd back at the Star Club was that these girls had climbed the next tier, which only made the precipice before them all the more appalling.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing that.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I felt like once again she's been shut out of a world that she can never rise within, but she's using her smarts and what's available to her to rise up in this different world.
That's right. When she finds herself in that world, she doesn't approve of it. She doesn't like its value. She simply accepts that she has certain things which will allow her to get on, and they are her looks and her brain. And so she makes use of them in a world which doesn't value much else. But she's not endorsing the system in which she finds herself. She's simply observing it and using her intelligence to try to get the better of it.
Right. If you've just joined us, I'm talking with L.S. Hilton, whose book Maestra is out on Putnam. One thing I wanted to ask you about with Judith as a character, I feel like as we move through the story, layers of her are revealed, and she keeps, you know, she goes deeper and darker.
I hope so. Thank you. I hope
than
she does.
Thought
yes.
She would before, and I'm just wondering, as a writer, how did that multi-layered character get created? I mean, was she that complex from the start, or did you discover things about her as you wrote the book?
I knew that she was going to have to be a complex person in order to carry the two strands of the narrative, the sort of the thriller plot and the art element. I think there were certain scenes which I'd plotted out which kind of went a different way because the narrative's recounted in first person, so I had always to be mindful of what would be convincing when told in her voice. But I also felt that because she's in many ways an anti-heroine, she has to get more interesting. She has to acquire more depth as we go along, and we have to both like her more, but perhaps believe her less as the story goes on. Because at times she's quite a scary character. At times she's very lonely. At times she seems like she's really kind of running out of control, and she even scares herself. So given that she's such an untypical heroine, I felt that she needed to be complex in order to maintain readers' interest.
Right. In the character and the setting of the book, I'm reminded of Patricia Highsmith's Tom Ripley.
Well, thank you. And, that's a very, very flattering comparison.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, was that an influence on your work? And if not, what were influences?
Well, consciously it wasn't, although it's a comparison that's been made. So perhaps it was knocking around in my brain. Yes, I think the character of Judith and Tom Ripley have a great deal in common. They're both characters who feel that they have a right to a different kind of existence than the one they have. They're both prepared to be violent and ruthless in pursuit of that. I suppose the difference is that in Highsmith's novel, the sexual element has to remain very much in the subtext, whereas in Maestra, it's very much there on the surface. That wasn't really a conscious influence. I was very interested, actually. I'm a big fan of kind of classic noir fiction, particularly Raymond Chandler. And I was very interested in Chandler's, you know, fantastic femme fatale and how one could play with the relationship between the detective and the femme fatale and how one could kind of maybe invert or subvert that convention. So I would say that was quite a conscious influence. heroines. And then I suppose one of my favorite literary heroines of all time is Becky Sharp in Thackeray's Vanity Fair, who is a young woman who has nothing but, you know, her wits and her face as her fortune, and sets out quite explicitly to see how well she can get along in the world using only that.
That's fantastic. I never would have thought of that comparison, but I think it's quite apt.
Thank you. Although I wouldn't in any way obviously compare myself to Thackeray as a writer, but in terms of the character and their motivations, perhaps.
Right, right. One thing I noticed about Judith is her, you know, obsession with fashion. She's always after the Chanel designer bag and the Tom Ford sunglasses. And it's part of her disguise, right? It's part of something she's putting on, but I felt like it goes deeper than that. It seems to soothe her somehow to...
There were quite a lot of elements of that, and I think that's a very good observation. I think, first of all, that Judith she's 25 when the book begins. She is the product of a generation which has grown up with brands, is quite unself-conscious. I mean, teenage girls talk about curating their brand, when what they mean is they're putting pictures of their vacation on Instagram. So branding, I think, is part of the consciousness of that generation. People measure their ambitions in acquisitions. And again, I don't pass a judgment on that. I simply thought it was a realistic detail. I think Judith, to an extent, is at the beginning of the book, she's a victim of that. And as you say, it soothes her. Possessions make her feel calm. They're also a measure of her ambition, what she's achieved. But as she progresses through the book and her tastes change, she has to change her appearance to fit in with the different environments in which she finds herself. Her taste becomes more sophisticated. And actually, she starts to lose that that reassurance that brands give her and replace it with something else. But there's another reason the brands are there, and it's this. When she finds herself in this very brash world of new money, which doesn't think about art in terms of aesthetics, but only in terms of financial gain, art and pictures are reduced to commodities. They're of no more interest or worth to many of the characters surrounding Judith than a Chanel jacket or a pair of sunglasses. So again, it was about making a connection between the commodification of the self, which I think is something that's happened to Judith's generation as a consequence of social media, Judith's self-conscious commodification of herself as something which, you know, she can use for gain, and the commodification of the artwork. These things are all integrated, and that's why the book is so brand heavy. It's also a little nod at Bret Easton Ellis's immortal Patrick Bateman. In fact, she has a little Patrick Bateman homage moment in the book, because Easton Ellis was the first person to use the way in which consumerism has penetrated consciousness so brilliantly back in 1990 when he released American Psycho. So there was a sense of Judith tipping her hat to an earlier incarnation as well.
Sure. You've stolen one of my questions, because
sorry.
It's fantastic. That whole...
I obviously meant it was a very good question.
Yeah, that whole thing, Bret Easton Ellis, you know, that kind of identification with that shiny thing. You know, and I have to say, mm-hmm. as I read the book, I thought, well, these people are so vulgar. But then at the same time, I was thinking, well, our whole society has become that. It's just, for them, price range is higher. But, you know, we're a society that creates desires for consumer objects.
Absolutely. And although they are quite vulgar, I mean, I realize I quite like some of them. Steve, this sort of unfeeling billionaire, and Carlotta, the ruthless gold digger, I actually got quite fond of them, and they're coming back in book two.
That's great. I did want to talk a bit more about Judith's kind of aggressive sexuality. And it's akin to something, you know, of course we're used to seeing it in fictional men all the time, but not necessarily in fictional women. And I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
I do have a great deal to say about it. Well, I was interested in writing a heroine who is transgressive, not just in terms of what she does, but in terms of literary convention, because it seems to me that there are still an awful lot of rules that that women have to obey on the page, and one of them is concerning sex, that women are considered to be emotionally motivated creatures. They can only enjoy sex either A, if it's, you know, romantic and meaningful, or if they're permitted promiscuity, it has to be because they've been traumatized in some way. They have to be damaged. and Judith is neither romantic nor damaged. I also think that books seem to be lagging behind the real world in terms of their treatment of sex. I mean, if you look on, you know, on Tinder, if you look at hookup culture, if you look at the kind of vocabulary and the kind of suggestions that are being made in a million chat rooms by a million women, you know, every minute, it would seem to me that sex in books is really rather kind of prudish and old-fashioned as opposed to sex in the real world. And this is not something that, again, it's not me making a judgment. I'm trying to write a realistic character. And I thought, well, okay, Judith is 25. She is a product of the Tinder generation. This is how she thinks about sex. This is the kind of vocabulary which it would be realistic for her to use about sex. So far from being shocking, I was just trying to be honest.
I feel that way too, that I've been watching that I believe was originally an HBO series, but Rome, you know, and a lot of the contemporary television is, I feel like, far ahead of literature.
Well, I mean, if you look at something really enormously popular like Game of Thrones, I mean, there's a lot of quite explicit sex in that, but somehow on the page, you know, women are still expected to behave and be described in a certain way. And I just think that's a bit old-fashioned. I think that, I mean, this is not meant to be, you know, a work of profound social realism. You know, it's not that sort of a book at all. It's a book for men and women. It's an entertainment. It's a thriller. But at the same time, I think you kind of owe it to your readers to sort of reflect some degree of reality and make some kind of comment on
right.
it.
And I feel like it's not only women too in literature, but I myself get very troubled. I read these novels with male protagonists where the only kind of sex they have is noble sex. You know, and
isn't that boring?
Yeah, it's totally boring.
And also because sex is not noble. Sex is loads and loads of things. Sex can be beautiful and romantic. It can also be dirty and anarchic. I mean, sex makes us do stupid things as a species, you know. We do all kinds of incredible things which seem to be very logical at the time because of desire. There's nothing polite or nice about sexual desire. And if there were, it would be very boring. I think acknowledging the darkness of our sexual desires is what makes us adults, and yet somehow the idea that a woman might explicitly, you know, say this is still seen as shocking, which I find extraordinary. Of course sex is dirty. I think it was Woody Allen who said it, wasn't it? You know, of course sex is dirty. It means you're doing it right. I paraphrase that.
Right. There's a painting that's referenced a number of times in the...
Judith and Holofernes. Yeah,
can you talk a little bit about that? First of all, I wondered whether you just made it up or whether it's an actual... painting.
It's in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. You should Google it. So it's by Artemisia Gentileschi, who was the daughter of a well-known painter, Orazio Gentileschi, a contemporary of Caravaggio's in Rome. She was apprenticed to her father. She had enormous talent, and she went on to become a very successful painter in her own right. However, her backstory is what really interested me, because when she was a teenager, she was raped by one of her father's apprentices. At the time, it was almost unheard of for a woman to bring an action for rape. But she took him to court very bravely, and one of the ways in which they tested the veracity of her testimony was by torturing her. Particularly, they put her hands in thumbscrews. So this is a woman who was prepared to risk not only her reputation but her livelihood to submit to physical torture in order to prove her case. And a lot of feminist art critics have read subsequently a story of revenge and sexual violence in her pictures, Judith slaying Holofernes being one of these. It's a classical biblical subject. There are thousands of versions of it. But what particularly interested me about it was not the element of sexual revenge, but the pragmatism with which Artemisia's imagining of Judith approaches her job. Judith is the biblical heroine who seduces Holofernes and then decapitates him in order to save her people. In most representations, and I have to say I include the master Caravaggio's here, Judith is a sort of pretty girl holding a rather ornamental sword, and even where the sword is sticking into Holofernes, it's not kind of doing very much. what I love about Artemisia's representation of it is that this is quite a beefy girl getting down to a serious job. She's sawing away at old Holofernes' neck, and there's blood everywhere. It's a mess. And what you see is a woman doing something very practical. And I feel that the picture's saying, you know, this is what women are capable of. Look what we can do, but also look at how we do it. You know, we do have a relationship with blood, with violence, with death, but we see it in a particular fashion. For us, it's a matter of pragmatism. And it was that that really inspired me to make that artwork the center of the novel.
Right. And I feel that that's the way that Judith Rashleigh goes about her work too.
Exactly. She doesn't. Each event in the book, which becomes more and more extreme, is a logical consequence of what's happened previously. And Judith's violence is very practical. She doesn't do nasty things for the sake of doing them, which is why this is not a revenge fantasy. She thinks revenge is a waste of time. Why would you bother doing that? She does what she perceives she needs to do in order to either get what she wants or, as the plot goes on, to get herself out of trouble, leading up to the climax of the book, which is very much a kind of them or me situation.
Right. She doesn't seem sadistic, and
No, she's not at all sadistic. No, not at all. I mean, she's sociopathic, but not psychopathic. She's perfectly aware of what she's doing, and she doesn't take any. Well, I'd say she doesn't take any pleasure in violence. I think she has an ambiguous relationship with it. Let us say.
Right. I was wondering about those ways. In which you make her feel sympathetic. Was that a hard thing to do for you, or?
Well, I did my best at it. I think it's for the reader to decide whether or not I've succeeded. I quite like Judith. She's like my wicked best friend. I have her in my head a lot of the time, so I'm very fond of her. But I don't know whether readers will feel the same way. I think it was difficult in that I wanted her to be plausible in every aspect of her character. And so obviously she's not a trained assassin. So I had to think of ways for the violence to work which could be realistic.
Right. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit, if you would, about the trilogy. I mean, this is not
certainly,
the end
yes.
of Judith, and I'm looking forward, and I'm sure many people are.
When I was about halfway through book one, I realized this was a much longer story. There is a little clue in book one as to what might happen in book two. There is something which is not what it seems. Book two is coming out next year. That's pretty much done. And book three to follow. I've been a bit busy recently, but I do know how it ends. There are some characters who come back, including Steve, the autistic billionaire, and Carlotta, the gold digger. And it's not quite what you think. I think it would be very boring for me as a writer and for readers if Judith didn't evolve and change, and she certainly will do that.
Yeah, I can expect that based on what I know about her already. I mean, I think that was one of the most delicious parts of the book was just when you think you know Judith, you realize in a very kind of frightening way that you don't.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad that you had that reaction to her.
Well, L.S. Hilton, thank you so much for joining us on Write the Book.
Thank you for such a delightful conversation.
And I wish you the best of luck, and I'd encourage all my listeners to go out and read this wonderful book.
Thank you very much.
That, again, was a conversation with L.S. Hilton. You can learn more about her work at her website, us.maestrabook.com. Before we close out the show this week, we also have a new book chat with Claire Benedict, co-owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Claire and I discuss summer reads for 2016.
It's good to see you, Claire.
Good to see you, Shayla.
And I'm excited to hear what is going on for summer reads this year.
There's a lot of good books out this summer. I'm excited about a lot of them. Novels, of course, are my favorite. One that's just out recently, and I think it's on the bestseller list right now, is called Homegoing by Ya Gyasi. I believe is how you pronounce her name. It's an epic story, kind of in the style of Cutting for Stone, which was such a huge bestseller quite a few years back now. starts in Ghana in the 18th century. It's a story of two half-sisters who don't even know of each other's existence. And they're, you know, teenagers, basically. One of them is captured as to be enslaved and is put in the basement of this castle. And the other is married off to the Englishmen, one of the Englishmen who are the enslavers, who live in the, upstairs in the castle. And they don't ever know of each other's existence. That's not the story. The story is their lines, their families. And through time and through history, through different geographies, what becomes of their families. And it goes right through to present-day Harlem.
Wow.
You know, it goes through the Civil War, slavery in America and in Ghana. And it's a really well-written book. It's a little tough, you know. Obviously, it's a serious subject. It can be a little intense, but it's not too difficult to read. It glosses over the Civil War a little bit. But what I love about this book is it really doesn't get too sentimental, and it doesn't get apologetic about anybody's role, including the Ghana people who were involved in the slavery and capturing their own people for slavery. So it's quite a look at a history that I didn't know very much about.
I was going to ask that. Like, if you don't know very much about the history.
No, that's okay if you don't, but you learn a lot in a really kind of interesting way. And you see where people come from and it's not all pretty. Not everybody ends up wonderfully successful and happy all the time.
Right.
Sometimes people do and sometimes people don't. And it's really, really well done.
Now, does the book start in that time period, the 18th century?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's linear. It goes right through to present day.
And there's not a single narrator? Or does it kind of
No, it follows
around?
Different family members. So, like, okay. Each chapter is the next generation of each of their lines.
Oh, okay.
So you're skipping around from different voices. But really well done. She has it balanced. This is her first novel. It's really quite impressive.
And is it out now?
It is out now.
Great. What's next?
Well, it's summertime, so you need a good page-turning thriller, and I know you like thrillers.
I do. I like thrillers.
Gotta have a thriller here and there, right? So this new one, Before the Fall, it's by Noah Hawley. I think it's going to be kind of like the thriller of the summer. It's pretty good. It's a private plane takes off from Martha's Vineyard. It's got the owner of the plane and a couple of his friends in it, and it crashes. The only survivors are this painter who they were giving a ride to and the owner's 9-year-old child. So the painter swims to Long Island shoreline with this 9-year-old on his back, which is an incredible feat in itself. Comes back, is a hero, meets the press and the paparazzi, which he wants nothing to do with. But the real story is, what about before the fall? What happened? Who are these people? Why did this plane crash? It didn't crash. It wasn't an accident.
Okay.
Why did this plane crash? Soon, it becomes soon apparent that it's not just an accident. Something was up. So the owner of the plane is this media mogul, richest man in America, kind of like a Fox News owner type.
Okay.
You know, there's a guy on board who's about to be arrested for securities fraud. One of the children on board had been kidnapped. Because they're so rich, had been kidnapped years earlier. Is that what's going on? You know, the pilots are. One of the pilots is fighting with the stewardess, and the other pilot doesn't like him. And you know, there's like all this kind of drama going on. And so the story is like, what happened?
So it starts with the crash, and then it goes
and then it
back
goes back to tell you. Yeah, so it's pretty suspenseful. It's very summery because you can see them. It's Sunday night. They're coming back to Manhattan from the vineyard, and they're all rich and perfect and everything. And then you find out everything's not really so perfect.
And is it a sort of omniscient narration?
It's mostly told from the point of view of the man who survived.
Okay.
And his experiences.
Okay. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Sounds
and the exciting. Investigators and then the paparazzi following him around, and they want to make him a hero, but then they want to tear him down, and then, you know.
Oh, so that's.
And then there's the uncle who's going to get the child who's been orphaned, and well, he want, you know, what does he want?
Right.
What are his motives? And so,
oh, that's a different kind of mystery.
Things.
So that's kinda,
yeah,
that sounds interesting. So that one is Before the Fall by Noah Hawley.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
So one of my favorite books for the summer is coming out in the beginning of July. It's called Siracusa by Delia Ephron.
Okay.
This is like a good, juicy, like, you won't want to put it down. You'll really read it really fast because it's just fun.
I'm glad. Because I'm going to get to interview her, so I'm excited.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be good. She must be wonderful.
And she's Nora's sister, right?
Yeah. This is great. This is two couples go on vacation together in Italy. They don't know each other really, really well, but one of the husbands used to date one of the wives, the other wife. And so kind of like they just kind of want to see each other again, so they bring their spouses along. I mean, not, you know, for any purposes, you know, that they shouldn't be, but, you know, they kind of have this relationship and they want to, you know, they want to get everybody together. So the one, so it's the two couples and one of them brings their 10-year-old daughter who's odd.
Okay.
I think odd is a fair word. And she doesn't really speak very much. And the mother's really type A and does all the talking for her.
Oh.
And so that's kind of a weird situation.
Right.
And the husband just kind of gives up and goes along with it. And the other couple are writers and they're both struggling and they've got their own issues. And so they're in Italy and they end up in Sicily at the final leg of their vacation. And everybody's got secrets. Everybody's got ulterior motives. And they're very, very smart, literate crowd and very quick. And it's very interesting. It's funny.
It is funny. Good. Because I love when
yeah,
she does funny.
It's witty. It's smart. But it's also just kind of juicy, you know? There's
yeah,
like sex and romance and cheating and betrayal and that kind of thing. So it's like, fun.
Yeah.
And so they all end up in Syracuse and in Sicily, and of course everything comes to a head. But the best part of this is what happens next is not at all what you think is going to happen next.
Oh, wow.
And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay. All right.
Because it's definitely, like, if you feel like from what I'm saying that you've read a book like this before and you can see where this is going, you're wrong.
That's so fun. That's so much more fun when you can't guess.
Yes.
Okay, great. Now, I think you mentioned that there are some Vermont authors that you would talk about.
Yeah. Let's see. Tom Green, who's the president of Vermont College of Fine Arts, has a new novel just out. It's called If I Forget You, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. He was just on the show. It was a good one.
Yeah. He writes good characters, and he really definitely knows how to tell a story. So
and
I
like
that
he tells a love story, you know, and he's always pretty good at telling love stories. And they're not romances. They're a love story. You know,
right. He does emotion well.
He does. And character. Yeah.
So I like that. There's a book of short stories by Jensen Beach, who's a Vermonter, called Swallowed by the Cold,
yes,
that I'm reading now, that's really interesting. Takes place in Sweden.
Okay.
Really good. Good writer.
He teaches at Johnson, I think.
Yes, and I think he might be VCFA faculty as well.
Oh, okay.
And then there's another really good a collection of short stories by a Vermont author. She's also a VCFA graduate. Robin MacArthur has a book coming out later this summer called Half Wild, and it's short stories, too, with a rural setting. And I really like those, too. Very, just really good writing, really good feeling of place and time, and nicely done. So some interesting...
Half Wild. Robin MacArthur. Okay.
So
good.
Some interesting things happening in our little state.
Yeah, I love that when there's new Vermont authors bringing stuff out. All right, Claire, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. It was fun.
Enjoy your summer.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Claire Benedict. Her Montpelier bookstore, Bear Pond Books, can be found online at bearpondbooks.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by Gary Lee Miller's conversation with L. S. Hilton. Her book, Maestra, is, as the author puts it, brand heavy. She mentions that her character Judith finds herself in the world of new money, which doesn't think about art in terms of aesthetics, but only in terms of financial gain. Art and pictures, she says, are reduced to commodities. They are of no more interest or worth to many of the characters in the book than a Chanel jacket or a pair of sunglasses. Hilton says it was about making a connection between the commodification of the self, something that has happened to Judith as a result of social media. This week, as a prompt, consider how you or one of your characters responds to brands and to the commodities of our society. Write a scene or poem about this, either in your own voice or in that of one of your characters. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. Archived episodes of Write the Book are on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at bigheavyworld.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, a radio show and podcast that comes to you from Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.